I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Israeli journalist, Channel One reporter, and editor Alon Vilan. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach V'Kasher. It's the second day of Passover today, the great festival of freedom and matzah. Actually, Pesach has four official names in Jewish tradition. Pesach, or Passover, of course, for the Paschal offering, the lamb that was sacrificed and roasted in the days of the Bible and the Temple. Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for this week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest of all names for Passover. And most thematically, Zman Chirutenu, the season of our freedom. Each of these has something important to teach us, and each is interesting in and of itself. The Hebrew word Pesach comes from the word for leaping or jumping, an apt description of the ways that young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us that the angel of death leaped over the homes of the Israelites when striking the firstborn of the Egyptians, and it also refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish that is prevented during slavery. Free people can cavort, if you will, skip or dance or jump as they please. Slaves jump to someone else's command. Hence, Chag HaPesach, the holiday of, well, skipping. The second name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of poor man's bread, matzah. Unleavened bread made with flour and water in 18 minutes or less, baked quickly and simply, the food that our ancestors made is preparation for a hasty journey in flight. Of course, on Pesach, we eat matzah all week, and therefore do not eat chametz, which is best described as being the opposite of matzah, that is, anything made with leavening or fermentation. That means lots of matzah. More about that later on this show. The third name for this festival is Chag HaAviv, holiday of springtime. Undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of the holiday of Passover. Spring is celebrated in every culture and nearly every religion, too. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal we held the last two nights that teaches the meaning and story of freedom in rich and wonderful ways, spring is featured in the green vegetables we dip in salt water and the hard-boiled egg, symbolizing the rebirth of spring. That's, by the way, where Christians got those hard-boiled eggs for Easter. The magnificent love poem, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is chanted on Passover, filled with images of gardens and growth and love in the flowering springtime. A wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of seasons. And finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is, of course, freedom. Zman Chirutenu, the time of our liberation. It is this essential ideal that's woven all through the week of Passover, the central focus on God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the world. In every generation, each of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally had been brought out of Egypt. In addition to our own celebration of our ancestors' freedom, we learn compassion and even empathy. For when we can view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we are compelled to sympathize with the dispossessed, a central principle in Jewish belief. Now, for me, the best way to feel the pain of slavery is to eat lechem oni, the poor man's bread, matzah. You know, I love almost everything about being Jewish, but my one area of personal aversion, the one Jewish food I find to be painful, is the one food we must eat in profusion this time of year, the ever-popular rendition of baked perforated cardboard, matzah, the bread of true affliction. For me, when the Israelites were given the choice between personal religious freedom and eating only unleavened bread, or staying in slavery, would have been a tough choice. I'm not sure that I wouldn't have chosen slavery in preference to matzah. I know I receive much criticism and lots of emails professing shock that a rabbi can't stand matzah. And after all, matzah with butter and salt is fabulous. Well, frankly, anything with butter and salt tastes good, including but not limited to newspaper and shirt cardboard. In fact, matzah's a lot like that. I mean, the French cook snails with butter and salt and claim they are edible, so we Jews do the same with matzah. But never let it be said that I can't be magnanimous on such subjects. I know that my distaste for matzah, my profound distaste for matzah, is not shared by most Jews. Of course, Jews are known for embracing suffering and having martyr complexes, so matzah might just be the perfect Jewish food. That explains it. As Marilyn Monroe, once the most famous convert to Judaism, said after enjoying this Jewish delicacy of matzah balls, "Isn't there any other part of the matzah that you eat?" That quote is also ascribed to George W. Bush, by the way. Sadly, no, unless you count the box. Actually, in spite of my protestations about my aversion to matzah, I'm the owner of a matzah tie. Not actually made out of matzah. That would be very hard to launder. Plus, how could you tell if you got crumbs on it? But actually, it's a silk tie with a very lifelike matzah print on it. I wear this tie religiously this week, and almost everyone admires it. And then I explain that it probably not only looks like matzah, but tastes like matzah, too. Yum. Anyway, our play-in this morning comes from our Passover musical playlist. It's a song about matzah, unsurprisingly, from the Seder we celebrated the last couple of nights. Ha Lachma Anya, this is the bread of affliction, isn't it ever, that our ancestors ate when they left the land of Egypt. Let all who are hungry come and eat. A madrigal version from the Western Winds, Ha Lachma Anya.
Hatana deara de
Mitzrayim.
Western Winds version of Halachma Anya, matzah, the bread of affliction. By the way, do you know what you call somebody who loves eating unleavened bread? A matzakist. Never mind. Just continue to enjoy eating matzah this week. When we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments, we'll meet our guest, the extraordinarily articulate Israeli journalist, reporter and editor of the public television Channel 1 in Israel, Ilon Vilan. You'll enjoy him when we come back on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. Or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means, nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Israeli journalist Alon Vilan. Chag Sameach, by the way.
Chag Sameach.
Pesach is a great holiday of freedom, and you know a lot about freedom of the press as a reporter, editor for Channel 1, the real public station in Israel. Explain a little bit to our listeners, if you would, about the difference between the channels in Israel.
Well, we until 1988, there was only one television channel in Israel, believe it or not. And it was only the television Channel 1, and we were the only one broadcasting. And since then, we have two more commercial channels, Channel 2 and Channel 10, which are stronger than us. They have more rating. But we are the only public channel. What is a public channel? We are not actually a government channel like in the other places in the Middle East where the government says to the newspapers or the television or the radio stations and the internet, you write this and that. We're actually are a part of the public. We get our money directly from the public and we write whatever we want to write. That means that I can criticize the government. I can write stuff against any prime minister, any minister. I can write whatever I want as long as I'm not inciting for violence or something like illegal. And I've done it in the past. I've criticized ministers. I've criticized my own government saying stuff. And you don't come from the right or from the left. Your job is to be the protector of democracy, the watchdog of democracy. So you do whatever you need to do, and it's a big difference.
Remember John Stewart saying on his show, you know, he had said something negative about Israel. He does it reasonably often, and he got a lot of flack from all kinds of people. And he said, you know where you can really criticize the Israeli government? In Israel. That is kind of unique in the Middle East, isn't it?
Well, it's a great thing. And don't think only about being a journalist. Think about being a civilian. I mean, one in every five Israeli went to demonstrate last summer.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Okay, unbelievable. Right. Think about 60 million Americans going and demonstrating in one summer. That's you cannot imagine that.
Okay.
Now, how much violence did the government respond against the civilians? How many people were killed? How many people were wounded? How many people? What did Benjamin Netanyahu said? Yeah, go and knock them out. No, he didn't say. He said, "All right, let them demonstrate." And you can apply the same mathematics to journalism. He lets the journalist criticize. Now, of course, there are problems with that. Of course, you don't have to generalize. Of course, Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't like criticism. He just doesn't respond with violence. He tries. You know, he has newspapers that are closer to him, and he's trying to have people that are journalists that are closer to him writing about him. But of course, the fact that people are not afraid physically to write against him gives them the opportunity to do it, and they do it as much as they can. So that's a big deal.
We'll talk much more about journalism in Israel and throughout the Middle East with our guest this morning, Alon Vilan, when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2jewishradio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. The last call for the Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan. It's going May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this great journey to Israel, email 2jewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and registration information. One of the fabulous aspects of Passover and the Seders is the rich store of commentary we get, and even the poetry it inspires. Here's the terrific poet Marge Piercy, a three-time guest of Two Jewish, by the way, in her evocative poem Matzah. Flat you are as a doormat and as homely, no crust, no glaze, you lack a cosmetic glow. You break with a snap. You're dry as a twig split from an oak in midwinter. You're bumpy as a mud basin in a drought. Square as a slab of pavement, you have no inside to hide raisins or seeds. You are pale as the full moon pocked with craters. What we see is what we get. Honest, plain, dry, shining with nostalgia as if baked with light instead of heat. The bread of flight and haste, in the mouth you promise home. The poem Matzah by Marge Piercy for Pesach. Passover is also particularly rich in both the melodic possibilities it offers and the varieties of types of music you can enjoy, both serious and silly. In the spirit of this holiday, it is both profoundly serious. What can be more powerful than celebrating freedom from oppression and praying for the liberation of all who are still enslaved, but also fun and silly? Here's one of my favorite takes on just what matzah is like. It's from Eric Schwartz.
I feel like a freak. Cause every time I pull out something to eat for this week, I can't do this. Cause I'm Jewish and I can't eat bread. Yeah, my rabbi said only matzah. Any way you wanna eat it, cold or hot, it's matzah. Fun for your mother, brother, sister, father, matzah. Buy in bulk for a lower cost per box, it's matzah, 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 matzah. Put on your, wait, that's over. So get your ass over to my pad, it's Passover. I'm the mad flow, a smoothie, and I hope you understand it. If you want the story of Passover, rent the Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston. But I got a question about the bread that is unleavened, causing indigestion, called matzah. Eat it for a week, we got stuff. No bread, no pasta. Best believe a Jew is stopped up. Now Moses made the matzah when he was fleeing Egypt. Had no time for bread to rise, he said, I just leave it, we can eat it like this, feed it to the Hebrews. But little did he know that the weight would end up equal, cause
let my people go
became the anthem. Get your damn hands up, maybe it will help you pass some. How could one bread rock is so famous when the taste is the same flavor of the box it came in?
Matzah,
eat it at once, ain't no second guessing.
Matzah,
leaving crumbs on my lap and chest, and it's called
matzah.
I found the afikomen in my small intestine.
Matzah, 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 matzah.
Now, if you never had matzah.
That was the smooth E, Eric Schwartz, talking about matzah on Passover. We are commanded to eat it all week. A whole sheet of matzah at the Seder last night in order to fulfill the commandment to eat unleavened bread and suffer as our ancestors did. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, Chag Sameach.
Boker Tov, Chag Sameach.
Happy Passover. We are going to celebrate the end of Passover with a big festival called Mimunah.
Mimunah, yeah, that's exciting. This is really something big. The Mimunah is a holy day coming to us from mainly from the Moroccan Jewish Jews. The name of the holiday Mimunah is a bit mysterious. People don't really know where it comes from. Some claim it comes from the name of Rabbi Moshe Maimon ben Yosef.
which is Maimonides, making it a very intellectual holiday, although that's not the spirit of it.
And the others claim that it comes from the Arabic word Maimon, which means luck.
Which is also close to Mamon, which is money. So good fortune, let's put it that way.
Good fortune, yeah. And, you know, you need luck to have money.
Indeed.
Or vice versa. Sometimes if you have enough money, you might have more luck. I don't know. Anyhow, this celebration is a festival with great Moroccan desserts and ethnic music. And it's celebrating the end of Passover. It's basically the first day where we can re-eat chametz. How do you say chametz in English?
Chametz, stuff that's not matzah. leavened goods, baked goods that aren't made with matzah meal. It's really, there's no word that translates to chametz.
So, you know, usually after all those days of Passover, especially if you keep it more strict and you really eat only the matzah and you don't drink beer because beer is created in the same fashion like bread.
Fermented grain, right.
And all the, and you know, I love Passover food, but it's fun for the first day. It's fun for the second day. It's a little less fun on the third day. And by the end of Passover, it's a festival when you get to eat real food,
right.
You know?
Bread, pasta, and donuts, cookies. Oh, we shouldn't talk about it.
And all those sweets and stuff. So yeah, we're bringing this celebration to Temple Emmanuel on April 14th, 7 o'clock p.m., will be a great time, family fun for all ages, from the really small ones up to 120 and more, whoever wants to come.
Great music, great treats, lots of fun activities for everybody, and a wonderful way to end Passover in a holiday that is itself maybe as much fun as all of Passover combined.
That's so true. So tis'adu v'tirbahu, which is the blessing for Mimuna. And come celebrate with us. April 14th, Saturday evening, 7 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel.
Thanks, Guy. Chag Sameach and a wonderful Mamuna to come.
Chag Sameach.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So not too long ago, you were in Rome. We started talking about the Roman Jewish community and the ghetto itself. And let's talk about the Jewish Museum there.
Right. Well, the Jewish Museum comprises two almost underground chapels, we would say today, which were medieval Jewish synagogues, each operating according to the traditions of the community which founded it, which were communities exiled from the Iberian Peninsula or elsewhere.
Right.
And on top of the Jewish Museum is this huge, magnificent new synagogue built late in the 19th century. So it's probably only 150 years old, which qualifies it as a brand new building in Rome. But what's particularly interesting about the museum and the guided tour is its emphasis on the antiquity of the Jewish community in Rome. It goes way back into the 3rd century BC and precedes by a long shot the arrival of Christianity in Rome.
Yeah, I mean, the story I always used to hear was that in an internecine fight between rival factions of the Hasmoneans, they came to Rome and settled in to lobby the Senate to get involved.
Right.
I don't know if that's the truth, but that's the Josephus story, I think.
Well, there were Jewish communities basically throughout the Mediterranean by the time of Christ.
Right.
And one of the really interesting things I thought was recorded in stone, in a stone tablet on the outside of the Jewish Museum. There's all kinds of stone tablets, some of which are headstones from graves, but others are other things, just sort of commemorating an occasion, and one of them commemorates the arrival of a rabbi from Hebron in the Holy Land, where Abraham is buried, legend has it, to solve a dispute between two of the medieval congregations among the crowded Jews in Rome. And the dispute was over not only property and dues and membership rivalries, not that that ever happens today,
no,
of course not, but also over ritual matters, like which congregation was doing it wrong. And I found it fascinating that here you have an example of more than 500 years ago, two neighboring congregations of Jews who literally were barely a stone's throw apart from each other, who couldn't get along to the point of needing to send from 2,000 miles away a rabbi from the Holy Land to adjudicate their little dispute. And part of the adjudication was that a wall should be built to keep these factions separate so that they didn't see each other and didn't arouse each other's ire. And I find it a fascinating subject that this kind of fractiousness and disunity seems to have characterized the Jewish people from the very beginning. From the time Moshe went up to Har Sinai to receive the Torah, the Jewish people were divided. And I'd like to get your views and those of your listeners on why Jews are like that, and apparently always have been and maybe always will be.
No, I mean, they're not like that. That's not true at all. I argue completely with it.
Right.
We will carry on this disputation and to this very interesting subject next week. Thanks, Tom. And Chag Sameach, a happy Passover.
And the same to you.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A British Jewish man is waiting in line to be knighted by the Queen of England. He's supposed to kneel and recite a sentence in Latin. His turn comes, he kneels, the Queen taps him on the shoulders with a sword, and in the panic of all the excitement of being knighted, he forgets the Latin. Thinking quickly, he recites the only other line he knows in a foreign language, which he remembers from the Passover Seder. Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelot. The puzzled Queen turns to her advisors and says, "Why is this night different from all other nights?" Yes, that's a classic old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you and Pesach. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. We have an odd situation for the next couple of weeks because we Reform Jews and Jews in Israel celebrate only 7 days of Passover, while conservative and Orthodox Jews outside of Israel celebrate 8 days. The Torah portions are out of alignment. Thus, this coming Shabbat will be the 8th day of Passover for those who keep an 8th day, and the Torah reading will be for that day, a special reading about the rituals of Pesach. While for the rest of us, it will be the 1st day after the festival, and the regular Torah reading will be Shmini from the book of Leviticus. We are following that practice here on Too Jewish, but if you object, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com, and we'll take your views under advisement. For most of us, then, this week's Torah portion is the 3rd in the book of Leviticus, Shmini, and it includes a very dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated, and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons, are entering into their office. God's presence fills the tabernacle. All is good. And then suddenly disaster strikes. Aaron's eldest sons, newly ordained priests named Nadav and Avihu, offer what is called Esh Zarah, strange fire, to the Lord. They are immediately struck down and devoured by a different kind of fire, dying before God. In the aftermath of this tragic shock, Moses consoles Aaron with strange words. God says, "By those brought near to me, I am consecrated and honored before the people." There is no word on whether Aaron accepted this as somehow a just ending for his sons. The text merely says, "Vayidom Aharon." Aaron was silent. We do not know the young priest's offense, if any. We are not told what the strange fire was. God decrees atonement offerings are made for whatever sin may have been committed, and the people are restored to God's favor. We also don't know why tragedy takes place or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Hebrew Bible, we have been shown more than we can understand. We do know that Aaron's silence may be the only real response to profound tragedy and loss. And our comfort may come only when we silently acknowledge our own powerlessness. This may seem small comfort indeed, but it is also an honest appraisal of our ability to comprehend loss. May God protect us from tragedy, but may God also give us the strength of Aaron when we have to face it, the ability to accept the painful inadequacy of our own explanations with dignity and courage. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the extraordinarily bright and articulate Israeli journalist Alon Vilan, will tell us what freedom of the press really means in the Middle East when we return on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Frankfurt, for the first time since the Nazi era began before World War II, a major German city has elected a Jewish mayor. Peter Feldman of the Social Democratic Party of Germany was elected mayor, receiving 57% of the vote and defeating Boris Rhein of the Christian Democratic Union. Feldman considers himself to be a liberal Jew. He's 53 years old. He's one of the founders of the Jewish wing of the Social Democratic Party. His election, which is considered surprising in Germany, puts an end to 17 years during which not a single candidate from that party was elected mayor. Feldman lives in Frankfurt with his wife and three-year-old daughter. He starts his term July 1st. In an interview with the Jewish-German newspaper Jüdische Allgemeine, Feldman stated that his Jewish identity did not play any role in the campaign. The fact that this issue did not come up is a testament to the strength of our open and liberal city, Feldman said. His campaign focused primarily on social issues. Frankfurt is the fifth largest city in population in Germany and its finance capital. Out of 700,000 residents, only 7,000 are Jewish, 1%. Alongside Berlin and Munich, Frankfurt is home to a very active Jewish community. Before the rise of the Nazis, the Jewish community was the second largest in Germany. The city even had a Jewish mayor in 1924, who was removed in 1933 when Hitler rose to power. Frankfurt's Jewish history is long and illustrious, going back to the 10th century, producing many great scholars, rabbis, and business leaders. And now, for the first time since the early 1930s, it has produced a Jewish mayor in a major German city. New finds around the Western Wall and Temple Mount in Jerusalem are changing history yet again. Textbooks for archaeologists and tour guides have always taught that King Herod, the Roman client king of Judea who lived from 74 BCE to 4 CE in Israel, saw his colossal building project in and around the Temple Mount in Jerusalem all the way through to completion. But coins, pottery, and oil lamps discovered recently in a mikveh, a Jewish ritual bath, underneath the Kotel, the Western Wall, date the completion of the Western Wall surrounding the Second Temple to a later time, perhaps as late as 50. They are sure that the coins found under the wall were struck long after Herod had already died. Archaeologists Rani Reich of the University of Haifa and Eli Shukran of the Israel Antiquities Authority lead the work around the wall. The new evidence, including coins of the Roman procurator Valerius Gratus, who served 15 years after Herod's death, helped in dating the construction of Robinson's Arch. Coins were found in a mikveh during excavation work to reinforce and maintain a 2,000-year-old main street in the old city of Jerusalem. This was the street used by ancient Jewish pilgrims going to the Temple Mount. Excavators came upon the mikveh and its buried treasure while working to expose the drainage channels under the street leading from the Shiloach Pool, the Siloam Pool in the City of David, to the Jerusalem Archaeological Garden near the Western Wall. Reich notes that the Jewish-Roman historian Josephus, a contemporary of the period of Herod, writes that he embarked on the project of enlarging the compound in the 18th year of his reign, 22 BCE, and describes it as the largest project the world ever heard of. Herod, who called himself the Great, isn't that neat? You call yourself the Great, is widely known for expanding the platform and the Second Temple in Jerusalem, the holiest site in the world for Jews. This is the location upon which the Muslim Dome of the Rock sits today. Herod is also known for building the beautiful port city of Caesarea on Israel's Mediterranean coast. Much of his work is reported in the first century book written by Josephus. While the evidence changes the timeline on the Western Wall construction, Shukran says this is an important step towards putting history in its rightful place. I think today we have put on the table that King Herod didn't finish building the temple area. Though it's generally been assumed the work took 8 years, this find refutes the notion. Even today, building projects take longer to complete than most contractors estimate. The same was obviously true in Herod's time as well, although there were about 18,000 men working on the job. Shukran says that the ruler who saw the completion was probably Agrippa II, the seventh and final king from the family of Herod the Great, and that was about 50 CE. And our News of the Weird department features Egypt, appropriate for this season of the Exodus. Apparently, tensions over Israel's peace treaty with Egypt have been sidelined in recent weeks by an issue no less important, soccer. According to Egyptian media reports, the parliament has accused Israel of poaching players of Egyptian heritage to play in the Israeli Premier League. Egyptian television first touched on this issue, mentioning Mahmoud Abbas of the Poel Tel Aviv team, George Imses of B'nai Yehuda, and several members of B'nai Sachnin as examples of athletes of Egyptian origin who have opted to play in Israel. According to the report, there are also 150 Arab players who are part of various Israeli soccer teams. Some of us would think that was a good thing for peace and cooperation, but not Egypt. The head of Egypt's Defense and National Security Committee, Ahmed Ismail, has requested that the People's Assembly carefully study the possibility that Israel might be pulling or even luring Egyptian athletes to play for its teams. Maybe they are luring them to Israel with offers of free matzah. No, probably not. And Samuel Glazer, a co-founder of the company that gave the world Mr. Coffee, one of the first and most popular automatic drip coffee makers to appear on American kitchen counters, died March 12th in Cleveland. He was 89 years old. It was Glazer's co-invention, Mr. Coffee, and the use of Joe DiMaggio as the pitch man that began America's turn from percolated, really terrible coffee towards the very drinkable, caffeinated stuff we all enjoy today. And that's the News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Alon Vilan. He is an Israeli journalist, works for Channel One as a reporter and editor, has broken some scoops, not only on the international desk, which he mostly serves, but also in education and other areas, covering the government, covering the society. We talked a little bit about Channel One and how it really is a public channel in the sense that government doesn't censor it. You can say what you want to say. It's symbolic, emblematic, really, of the freedom of the press that's central to the vibrant Israeli society. You're not born in Jerusalem, so you're not a Yerushalmi, but you live in Jerusalem in a very diverse area. That's more common than not in Israeli society, isn't it?
Well, to live in a place like that in Jerusalem, I mean, most of the journalists, believe it or not, live in the state of Tel Aviv. I mean, this is an entirely different place now, and Channel 2 and Channel 10 are based closer. I mean, Channel 2 is closer to Jerusalem, but the majority of the journalists are actually coming from Tel Aviv. And I think it's very important to live in Jerusalem, because if you're covering, most of the time, if you're covering something that involves Jerusalem, and if you don't understand what's going on there, the complexity of this city in terms of secular people, ultra-Orthodox people, Arabs and Jews, East and West, a lot of the times the Americans, they hear that Israel is, let's say, building in East Jerusalem, and we live there and we say, well, actually, it's not East Jerusalem. I mean, why do they say that they're building in East Jerusalem where they're talking about the South? Or they're talking about...
Sometimes the West is somehow East Jerusalem, right?
Yeah, Ramot is closer to Tel Aviv, actually. So when you live there and you understand the complexities, there's no more right or left, or us and them. It's you find impossible coalitions inside Jerusalem. Sometimes Arabs and religious people against ultra-Orthodox, or ultra-Orthodox with secular people against other people. I mean, it's very interesting. In order to see the gray, I think you have to live there.
I remember Teddy Kollek used to talk about Jerusalem as this incredible mosaic of peoples. You live in French Hill. That's a mosaic of people all by itself.
Yeah, you have secular people and religious people. You have a big community of Koreans, believe it or not. Why do Koreans come to the French Hill? Why do they come to Israel? Because they're...
For the best kimchi in the world. Really,
First of all, it's the best kimchi in the world. But also, they want to learn about... Israel, and they want to learn how to read the Bible in Hebrew. So they come, and the community is already...
What better place, of course.
Yeah. And they're very good neighbors, believe it or not. And they make good kimchi and bulgogi.
Yeah, maybe they can call it kimchai. Let's talk a little bit about your experience in meeting other journalists throughout the Middle East, because you don't just stay in French Hill, you don't just stay in Jerusalem, you travel, you get to meet everybody. That's what journalists really do. Talk a little bit about that experience and what the other journalists around you are like.
Well, the experience with the Palestinian, the Egyptian, Jordanians, even the Syrians, that's a very interesting point, became when I started a few years ago to go with them on programs with the European Union or other organizations, the Thompson Foundation. They take you on all other places, and they bring people from all around the Middle East. Now, believe it or not, the Palestinians and the Egyptians, they have their own problems with each other. I mean, sometimes the Egyptian will not talk to a Palestinian journalist because he's not pro-Hamas. He's a pro-Palestinian... Fatah, Palestinian Authority. So he will be mad at him for being that modest, okay? And the Syrians, they don't talk to you at all. And the Jordanians, they're very modest, but again, there a lot of what they write is against Israel. It's not, you cannot say that it's anti-Semitic. You cannot say that at all. They recognize you as a Jew. They don't hate you as a Jew, but constantly bringing on the Palestinian problem as the only problem is in the Middle East. I mean, they don't talk about refugees in Jordan. They don't talk about the problems in, you see problems in Syria.
Full civil war in Syria.
Civil wars in a lot of places in the Middle East. No, it's the Palestinian Egypt. Problem. Again, 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 it gets boring sometimes. But when you talk to them, you realize that you're proud of being Israeli. I mean, as an Israeli, I criticize my government all the time. You know, Israelis, they say that everything is bad and everything is rotten.
They're Jews, so
everything is corrupt. Yeah, it's a Jewish thing, and it's also an Israeli thing.
Definitely.
But then you go and you meet with those people. You find people that are very intelligent, very educated. They are the elite. Sometimes, you know, elite because they're only taken from one part of society in order to become journalists. And you see that those people have a problem with journalism. They cannot say one bad word against their government.
You're talking about the Arab journalists now?
All the Arab journalists, all of them. When I used to meet with journalists from Egypt during the Mubarak regime, okay? They had nothing bad to say about Mubarak regime. Now they will say other things, okay? Now they will you won't hear them
same
say,
people.
Yeah,
right?
Same people, the one who still have their jobs, will not say anything bad about the military regime in Egypt.
The current regime. Right?
Yeah, the current regime. So I see that as a problem as being journalists. They all think that they're perfect journalists. The Palestinian journalists believe that they live in a democracy. Okay, I found that a little bit funny because they say, listen, we had open elections. And Jimmy Carter came and he was there and he was supervising the elections. So he said it was open elections. We're a democracy. So I asked them, so can you criticize Abu Mazen, the head of the Palestinian Authority? They become a little bit embarrassed and then they said, no, but we're other journalists. We do other stuff. So I said, okay, but do you confront other problems that are not the Palestinian-Israeli problem, which is a huge problem, I would say, okay? But
there are other things, or basic social
corruption,
services.
The place of the woman in society, right. Agriculture, other stuff. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be taking care of the Israeli Palestinian side. Can you criticize your own government if you want? And they will say no. And so they believe that they are real journalists. But I see it in a different way, and I talk to them and I try to confront them about it, but there is a problem. Explain to someone who believes in something that he is wrong.
We were talking a little bit off mic about the Jordanians. It seems to me that some of the really more sophisticated Arab regimes, and those are maybe the less stable ones or maybe the less automatically secure ones, understand that they have to let off some steam. They have to let journalists criticize small things. Is that true?
I believe that is true. They will never say it publicly. But in closed conversation, you can actually find hints to the fact that the government will tell a journalist to criticize the government a little bit, and then it can show off. It can show off to the United States. It has
open press, free press.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. And it's funny, but you will never find real criticism like you find in the United States, in France, in Great Britain,
right.
Or in Israel,
right.
Against the government. Sometimes the criticism in Israel is so bad that you say, wow, they went too far with this criticism. I mean, the prime minister and the minister, they're only human beings. I mean, what are you expecting of them? And they want them to have a cape on and fly around and saving people. Sometimes it's impossible. But in Israel, you can do that, and there you can't do that. And then you say, well, it's a little bit artificial, the kind of criticism that you have, very modest, very small. You always have the right of the government spokesperson will say something which will be very, very, very convincing in return, and that will be the end of the debate. So
very interesting. When I was living in Israel a long time ago, this brand new phenomenon occurred. Everybody got mekubalimed. They started to put cable television in. It was a brand new thing. And all of a sudden...
Beginning of the 90s,
right. 91, 92, okay. It was a fascinating time because suddenly you could get... it was very big then. MTV Asia and Europe, you know. It added a lot of channels. It didn't really seem to add a lot of content. Talk a little bit about sort of Israeli television in general. You know, what's its place in society now?
Well, I think it's one word will summon everything up. Reality. Okay, you have if you have the Kardashians here in the United States, believe it or not, in Israel they are interested in the Kardashians. They know who Khloe and Kim and
I don't. I just.
You
I just.
Yeah, just, I remember.
You should have to have some talent, yeah, shouldn't you?
Well,
I don't know.
I remember the father, you know, Robert Kardashian. So that was reality for me. But Israelis really are concerned about reality. A lot of the newspapers and the internet site and the television is about the Big Brother and the big race and everything like that. And the hardcore news right now in Israel evolves around something that happens with the Big Brother. Okay, they have a scandal there that the participants were given drugs against their will and with their will, and then so a lot of the you see not on the culture parts of the newspaper, you see on the main pages of the newspaper things that involves around reality. People are running away from the real reality into their television.
The fake reality. Sounds just so American. I don't really know how else to describe it.
It is. You're taking all the bad parts of the United States. There are a lot of good things that you need to take, and you're leaving them here.
It's and very interesting.
Yeah.
So one of the observations that I think a lot of, I don't know if many Americans see this when they go to Israel, but because we're used to American culture, but you know, I've been going to Israel now for a while, and I see it becoming slightly more Americanized and also more Europeanized, if you will. Some of that's great. You know, you can actually get around the country now on a real live highway network, and there's all kinds of, it's a much more affluent place. But, you know, there's lots of malls. I mean, when you look at the culture as a journalist, what do you see?
Well, it's a subjective thing. I personally don't like it because I live in the United States and I see so many good things about the United States. And I say, let's import a few of them and let's keep a few of them out. Now, when you talk about malls, it's a part of the economy. You can't have not have malls. But when you talk about on Independence Day, having people running with American flags as alongside Israeli flags, I see that as a problem because this is Israeli flag. On 4th of July, you can be running with American flags in Israel. Great. I'll be happy. But on Israeli Independence Day,
that's
a little
bit
too much for me. I think that we need to import the way that Americans are behaving on the roads, okay? Americans are a lot more kinder on the roads than they are in Israel.
To be honest, we're better drivers.
Yeah, so let's
import that. We kill a lot less people per capita.
Per capita. And so let's import that. Let's bring that to Israel from the United States. Let's be a little bit kinder, but let's leave a lot of the shopping,
the commercialism,
as we said before, the reality. Let's leave it here. I don't think that Israelis are listening to what I have to say about that, but there is a portion of Israelis that is sick about it. You see it a lot on Facebook. You see a lot of people who are writing stuff against shopping, against reality, against ultra capitalism. You know, not all the Israelis are liking that.
If there were one thing you could export from Israel to the United States, what would it be?
I would bring the sense of being improvising all the time. It's not only improvising. You know, you remember the show MacGyver? We're a middle generation. We're not very young people.
He takes two shoelaces and a piece of wire and he blows up a helicopter building or something.
You know?
That's it.
So Israelis are like that. They are all small MacGyvers. And we're not talking only about being in the field and creating something. They're improvising when they're working in an office. They're improvising. So that is something I think, you know, you have people from South Korea and Singapore. The strongest economies in the world, in Singapore, it's per capita, but in Korea is the 10th strongest economy in the world.
The entire world, right.
And they're coming to Israel in order to learn how to improvise. And I'm very proud of that. So maybe Americans can do that a little bit too. That'll help them, I think.
Export Israeli entrepreneurship to the original entrepreneurial country. Alon, thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique,
Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the Iranian Jewish author and poet Roya Hakakian. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout from our Passover playlist of pleasurable passages of Pesach song is a Sephardic setting of Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim from the Psalm for Passover, when Israel went out of Egypt. My friends, have a Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, a happy holiday of Passover, a Zisen Pesach, and a Shavua Tov, a good week of peace.
בצאת ישראל ממצרים, בית יעקב מעם נועז, הייתה יהודה לקודשו, ישראל ממשל נותר, הים רעה וינוס, הירדן יסוב לאחור, ההרים רקדו חילים, גבעות כבנצות, מלך הים כתנוס, הירדן תיסוב לאחור. ההרים תרקדו חילים, גבעות כבני צאן, מלפני אדון הלכו לי ארץ, מלפני אלוה יעקב, ההופכי הצור הגמיים, חלמיש למיינו מים.